The employer can't do everything. The employer cannot fix everything that's wrong in life. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding sometimes with it for individuals, that their employer can fix it all and can carry it all. When, as we know, businesses can't, we haven't got the wherewithal. Even larger corporations, you have not got the wherewithal to carry every problem.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Burnt Chef Journal, a hospitality-specific podcast dedicated to challenging mental health stigma and conversations designed to inspire a new, healthier, happier, and more sustainable hospitality profession. So this week I'm joined by Liz Burley, who is the director of Burley Law. Liz, good afternoon. I was going to say good morning, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Chris. I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, a little cold on this 1st of March. The month has started off with a chill in the air. Decidedly damp in Birmingham in the UK here.
Yeah, we've had so much rainfall over in the UK that all the water tables are just backed up now. We're being flooded left, right and centre, aren't we?
Yeah. There's no chance for us cold water swimmers. Hey, I'm one. There's no chance of getting in rivers because they're just full of, you know, the stuff that's getting pumped in, the water companies having to offload or whatever they do every time the water table is too high. It all goes into the rivers. So, they're not very clean at the moment.
There's a huge campaign on at the moment, isn't there, to clean up the waterways, because wild swimming and open water swimming has become so popular in the UK. Unfortunately, a lot of the sewage that's now being pumped into the river makes a lot of it unsafe to do so. So there's huge campaigns in the UK to try and clear up the waterways, aren't there?
There is, but I think it's an infrastructure problem from what I'm hearing. I watched a lovely Joe Lycett did a brilliant, lovely documentary on it in the last week and made it very humorous, but also serious. But the point that came through really strongly is the antiquated system that we're dealing with. So it's not fit for the capacity that it's having to put through, if I can put it that way delicately. It's needed huge investment over many years. It's not a quick fix.
It's one of the benefits of being one of the oldest countries in the Western-speaking world, but also at the same time, a lot of our systems are still very much built like they were back 300-400 years ago.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I don't know about the sewers, but the railways were certainly built by the Victorians, and that's another conversation, isn't it?
This is History with Liz and Chris. Come live. Yeah.
Wasn't what I signed up for, Chris.
Well, no, I mean, I'm way out of my depth. I'm way out of my depth.
Me too. I'll have to make it up any further.
I did geography at school. I didn't do history. I can't change history, whereas geography, you can do a little bit. So, Liz, for those who haven't had the pleasure of working with you, and we at the Burnt Chef have kindly used your services, and we've been chatting now for, I think our first conversation was as I was about to jump out of a plane on a really hot, sunny day.
Did you do it?
Yeah, of course I did, yeah.
You didn't turn back.
No. That was my second jump as well, that one. I've done another one since then, so... Yeah, good. Yeah, great fun. Honestly,
I haven't done any. I've never jumped out of a plane.
Well, lucky for you. In the UK, we have over 30 or 20 airfields that you can jump from at any time and raise some funds for a great cause.
Let's put it this way. I'm not good with heights, and I'm a swimmer, as I've mentioned. I can't even jump in off the side. That's too far for me. So I don't fancy my chances from a plane.
I appreciate that. I mean, you're not up high for long and you don't have to jump. You kind of just fall.
Or get pushed.
Yeah. It's an experience. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I don't. Good way of raising money. Brilliant.
Liz, you specialise specifically in a certain type of law. Are you able to just give the listeners an idea of where your specialisms and experience lies, please?
Yeah, so as a firm, we cover two broad areas. One is commercial law, and that focuses in mainly on IP, intellectual property protection, so protecting things through trademarks, copywriting, that kind of thing. But my side of the business is employment law focus, so that's my stock in trade. I've been an employment lawyer knocking around now for the best part of 30 years. So starting my career in the mid-90s when, in the UK, working life looked quite different to what it does now. Working ways of working, working practices, expectations and all of that, the dynamics of how you work, when you work, the people you work with, you know, changed about face since then. Yeah, and my career has gone not very linear. I studied out qualifying as a solicitor, did a law degree, and specialised quite early on in employment law, but also did other work around litigation. So that's court cases involving road traffic accidents, personal injury, that kind of thing. But decided that I liked working with the people focus that employment law gives. So specialised in that, went to work for bigger firms after I qualified, and really kind of dealt with a huge variety of work, focusing in on conflict. So mainly around employment tribunal litigation. So we have a quite an informal system of the legal system of, you know, how you bring a claim. If you're an employee in the UK, it's called the employment tribunal system. It's a slightly different system to the, you know, kind of like the commercial courts. And so the employment tribunal system is where I kind of grew up as a solicitor and did lots of work defending claims mainly. A lot of the early work I did was for a very large household name brewery and pub estate. So got my hands dirty with a lot of unfair dismissal claims because, you know, there seems to be a lot of quite a big revolving door in the pub industry back then. Probably hasn't changed much. And a whole variety of issues around, you know, misconduct in the workplace and disciplinaries and grievances. And then fast forwarding, I took a break out of my legal career for 10 years, just stopped, didn't want to do law anymore, had kids, brought up kids, did quite a few other jobs, mainly focusing in on the kids and their lives. So I worked in schools, ended up working for a church out there in the community and in schools. So very different to the life of a lawyer. And then came back to law and legal practice in 2015, had an opportunity to get back in, dust down my skills, find my confidence, which was buried very, very deep down, and just give it a go again. And that's what I've been doing since 2015. So having had a gap of 10 years, that was interesting. You know, it's not the easiest thing in the world to go back to a job that you haven't done for 10 years. And kind of that, yeah, having that kind of professional advisor role, that can be quite daunting if you've taken a break from it, whether it's, you know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever the break is. I think it was an interesting experience picking up my career again in my mid to late 40s. But I've done it.
You've done it. And so how much of the work that you do currently is based around hospitality? Is it still heavily focused or not so
much? Not so much now. Our firm is based in Birmingham in the UK. For any international listeners, that's you know, about 200 miles north of London. And in the Midlands, and Birmingham is the, you know, is a huge thriving city and has been since the Victorian age. And it has a growing and thriving tech startup and scale-up scene, a number of universities that, you know, very entrepreneurial. So nowadays I find myself in the midst of this tech community in and around businesses that are either early stage or have matured slightly. They're growing tech businesses, but they're mainly focused in on tech solutions. But we have other clients as well who are more in the more traditional sectors. So I do have a couple of hospitality clients. One is a venue in the Birmingham city centre, and another one is a tech focused solution that is for hospitality businesses. So they're a supplier to sort of pubs and restaurants, and it's around payment, taking payments electronically. And that's a whole interesting concept. Might touch on that later. Yeah, our other clients are in the traditional sectors, engineering, manufacturing, education providers. So a whole variety really now of different sectors.
Mm. So let's just start with a clarification then. Irrespective of how brilliant we think that the hospitality industry is, or we know the hospitality industry is, and how lawless it feels at times, we still come under, in the UK employment law, and same with places like Australia and Canada, etc., that you come under your own employment law, despite the fact that some environments may not necessarily seem to respect those laws. So in your experience, has been sort of the key areas that you would find that hospitality clients, hospitality defendants, whatever it might be, are missing within our particular sector?
Well, yeah, I think sector by sector is an interesting way of looking at it. I sometimes come at it from a different perspective. Each sector's got its own culture and its own pressure points, its own challenges, which I think do determine how people are treated, how people are developed, how, you know, the politics of the industry, whatever. But I think there's another aspect to it. So the way I sometimes look at it is the size of the business. So within hospitality and any other sector, you're going to have huge players who are, you know, chains of restaurants, pubs, venues, whatever, right down to the little guys, you know, one-man band people, you know, kebab vans or pop-ups. And the important thing is that the employment law framework applies to all of them. It isn't that certain sizes of employers, certain, you know, above a certain threshold of number of employees, you have to comply at this standard or with these laws and then scaling down to smaller players. No, it applies the same right across the board. Typically, I used to find, probably still do now, whether it's hospitality or any other sector, that the smaller the business, the smaller the enterprise, the more difficult it is for people, you know, investing in people to be a priority in terms of time and money. Why? I mean, you know, you're running your business, I'm running mine. We know that you wear many different hats. Your time's a finite resource. You can't delegate stuff. You don't have departments to pass HR onto. It's all down to you. It's on your shoulders. So it's more pressurized for the smaller businesses, for sure. It doesn't mean that they don't want to do it well. And I've been astonished over my time in, you know, advising employers and employees, seeing it from both sides, how badly it can be done at big corporate level, even though they have got bigger pockets, departments of people who should know what they're doing. So it doesn't always follow that the bigger organisations do it better. And if I was to point to one thing where I think most employers fall down for whatever reason, whether they can't be bothered with it, or there isn't the time and the energy, there isn't the money to pay for professionals to help them to do it, it's on process and communications. Those are the things. Not having good processes in place to either manage risk or risk of claims, I mean, or do things well because they want to do things well. You know, hospitality is a very pressurized environment at the end of the day, isn't it? With slim margins, there isn't the luxury of time and money, you know, in terms of investing in processes to always do things as well as businesses might want to do them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the conduit. That's one of the key components, I guess, of working in this sector, is that the intentions always have been there. And I think that we're a very caring industry. We want to do our best. We want to make sure that we're influencing and impacting people's lives. But I think that the time element allows us very little emotional or intellectual space to be able to manage these things. It's often a case of survival. You know, we're doing what we can do to keep afloat. So let's take a business like this, for example. You know, we've got in total 28 people that work for the organization. We want to make sure that our teams are well looked after. We've got policies in place. We've got procedures. But we have no HR lead. Is that something that a small organization like this should consider investment into, especially when it comes down to mitigation of risk?
Ideally, yes, but it's about having the resource to do so, isn't it? And most small organizations, I'd say typically that is businesses of 50 people or less, do not have the wherewithal to employ somebody. Most smaller employers go for a cost-effective solution of maybe having that available as an external resource to, you know, on tap when they need it. And that can be effective because it means you've got that kind of filling in the gaps. When you need it, it can be there for you, but it's not dedicated. So it's not growing with your business, and it's not necessarily getting to know your business and understanding it. It's just, you know, it's just on demand. So I'd say that probably, you know, when businesses reach a critical point of having 50 to 75 plus people, I think there should be a dedicated HR resource, whether that's brought in from outside and dedicated for some hours a month or employed from within. But it should be somebody who is now starting to work closely with the operational business and the executive to understand the HR priorities and challenges and needs, and planning ahead. Some strategic thinking is important. Otherwise, things start to become fragmented. Things are misaligned. I think it stores up a lot of problems for the future if people don't understand how they fit into the bigger mission of the business. And like you say, you know, in the day-to-day, who cares too much about that? We're busy fighting fires. We're busy making the corn, aren't we? But there has to be somebody or some space in a business for that thinking to be done and that driving purpose to be at the root of everything.
Yeah. And it comes on to a very interesting question from a mental health well-being and a litigation point of view that I'd like to ask. But the reason why I'm asking is for context from my own personal experience. I was a appeals officer for a case once with an organization. And this organization was a great organization. Lovely. I loved working for them. It was my last employed role. And I was an appeals officer for a case where an individual had been caught stealing from the business. And it went to appeal based on a breach of process during the appeals process. And in court, you're thinking, well, this individual is they're a prolific thief. We've got evidence. We've got video evidence of the fact that they're a thief. But because of the fact that there was a small mislanguage of a particular part, it was told that an investigation had already commenced before giving notification. The claimant was ended up awarded damages. So from a well-intentioned organization and from an organization who wanted to do the right thing, who had a HR team in place, not taking action and not fully understanding and getting the right level of support was actually quite a costly mistake to make. And, you know, you often think that these things would never happen, but in this instance, it was. So that's for context of experience. So I guess the question for me is when it comes down to the subject of mental health and well-being, are there any interesting cases that you've seen recently whereby businesses, well-intentioned businesses, have been caught out from claimants specifically around mental health and well-being at all?
I've dealt with a few cases over the last few years that where mental health has been an aspect. It's not necessarily been the main focus of the claim. You know, it's not like that I'm claiming mental health discrimination, for example, but it has perhaps played a part in a disciplinary process, for example, or a performance management process. I handled a case that was very tragic, actually, in some cases, where I was acting for the business, and it was in the hospitality trade, funnily enough, the pub business. There was a manager in one of the pubs who had, there'd been a few issues performance-wise, but mainly around, this is where things really come into play, isn't it, with hospitality. The detail of things like stock takes and handling of stock and missing stock can often be very, very important in performance management. Why? Because stock is cash, you know, cash is the business, blah, blah, blah. So this guy had, there'd been some things missed, and then they really started to home in on him. And it transpired, again, they got some film footage, it transpired that it looked as if it was him either taking the stock or allowing somebody to come in from outside and taking stock. Couldn't be proved, you know, to a criminal standard, but good enough for an employment case. But he went off sick, and he had had mental health problems previously before all of this kind of started kicking off. And he had had time off, and I think he'd had some treatment, antidepressants. But very sadly, during this investigation, he tried to take his own life. And in that scenario, you know, somebody advising the business about what to do, you have to put the stoppers on. You cannot plow on with the disciplinary process when somebody is in a mental health crisis. But there is pressure, you know, from within the business to do it because, as you know, businesses, if they stalemate, if they stop for any length of time, that's going to have a massive impact on bottom line. So, yeah, it was a difficult situation to navigate through. They did their best. And I, you know, it's costly, but I had to be with them every step of the way. All communications had to be vetted, and we were, checking in every day to see how he was. And I think eventually we got him into a disciplinary hearing, and this is when he was well enough to come back to work. And it was some weeks down the line. But he kept coming back to the mental health challenges as his sort of defense. And that too was difficult, because then you've got to really cut through whether it really was a reason for behaviors or whether it's being put forward, not necessarily dishonestly, because I'm not sure if many people would do that, but whether it was put forward really as a desperate attempt to keep his job. And why wouldn't he? It's really difficult. That's one case that springs to mind. I mean, I acted for another individual more recently, and this wasn't so much a mental health case, although it was really, who'd had a brain injury, not related to work, from outside of work, was on a horse one day, fell off, injured a brain. And she was in professional services. She worked for one of the very large professional services organisation. And very sadly, ultimately, she was, I mean, a lot of people use the word let go, which is a turn of phrase I really don't like, because it doesn't, it massages the truth. She was dismissed. She was sacked for performance, for capability, in very, very sad circumstances, because actually she was disabled as a result of the accident. And in a very large organisation, you would hope that they might have been able to find her some other work to do if she couldn't carry on doing the role she'd signed up for. But they weren't able to. The challenge was too great, and she had to go. But, you know, the impact of that on that individual was absolutely devastating, particularly after the accident that had left her pretty much permanently brain damaged. Sometimes with the best will in the world, the employer can't do everything. The employer cannot fix everything that's wrong in life. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding sometimes with it for individuals, that their employer can fix it all and can carry it all. When, as we know, businesses can't. We haven't got the wherewithal. Even larger corporations, you have not got the wherewithal to carry every problem.
That's such an important topic that gets brought up quite a lot. We're at this stage where we speak to our community and we speak to our stakeholders. Our stakeholders are C-suite, organizations going, we need help. Community are going, we need help as well. And there's an expectation between the two of them that at some stage it needs to meet in the middle. And it's not meeting in the middle currently.
No.
So to really sort of help individuals, because I think this is a question we get off, one of two parts that we get asked a lot, which is, where does the responsibility of the employer end in terms of managing and helping individuals with their mental or physical health or financial health, versus where should the responsibility of the employee start to up? Like, how much responsibility for self-care should the employee have as well? Mm. And I think that is a big, big question, because employers sometimes are going, we're trying to do everything for them, which then spurs the employee on to ask and expect for more. Whereas in fact, there is legal and professional and moral boundaries that you have to uphold, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. An employer isn't expected to do everything. So I think where it's helpful to start is kind of in the language of the legislation that underpins employment law in the UK, the Employment Rights Act. And if we look at employment law from two main strands, really, one is unfair dismissal, which is a key employment law right in the UK. It's kind of like the gold standard. You know, once you've been employed for 2 years, you have the right not to be unfairly dismissed. And that's the main claim that tends to be in front of tribunals. But the other strand of law, which I think is highly relevant here as well, is discrimination. We have discrimination laws that protect any worker, employee, worker, casual staff, agency staff, consultants, whatever, from being discriminated against. What does that mean? Treated less favourably, not treated more favourably. There's no duty to treat people more favourably, but there is a duty, you know, to avoid less favourable treatment for certain groups of people. Again, not everyone. So if you want to rely on discrimination, or you have to be able to fit into what's called a protected characteristic. And if we're thinking about mental health, the one that most people would reach for is disability. Why? Because it's about having a long-term mental or physical condition. So mental health disorders would fit into that box. So from a mental health point of view, then, how far, or financial well-being generally, how far should an employer go and have to go, and when it should it start becoming the employee's responsibility? And unfortunately, the law doesn't place a line in the sand, but it does talk about a lot about reasonableness and proportionality. Now, those are words that we could hang many, many different meanings on, and they are tested through case law in the courts, as you'd expect them to be. But in terms of reasonableness, the unfair dismissal right places very squarely the duty on the employer. So if they're going to sack somebody, the onus really is on them to show that it was reasonable. There's no onus on the employee. And just going back to that case that you described that you were involved in, sounds like a really terrible decision and not appropriate in the circumstances. But reasonableness is all about process and, you know, substance of facts and what can be established and what was in the employer's mind. Was it reasonable to form that conclusion? Should they have done anything more to investigate? Should they have considered anything else? So there isn't a one size fits all answer to each scenario. You know, if you're looking at a theft versus you're looking at somebody that's ill and can't work, those contexts are very different, and then necessarily the things that have to be considered about reasonableness will be different in those contexts. But, you know, from an unfair dismissal point of view, reasonableness is the key and fair process is the key. So we're not saying that employers are like police officers. You know, we know that in a police case that's then pursued to a criminal court, if there's a criminal case against somebody for robbery, the standard that's got to be proved is beyond all reasonable doubt. Mm. It's not like that in employment disciplinary cases. The standard is the balance of probabilities, and it's about what the employer had as information at their fingertips. So I think, as you know, if we're talking about investigation of misconduct, or if we're talking about mental health that leads to poor attendance at work or poor performance, it's about what the employer reasonably can do in the circumstances to avoid a dismissal or to avoid whatever the discriminatory, you know, the complaint of discrimination is. So somebody doesn't get a job, or they are not allowed to take more time off, and they say that's discrimination. Should the employer have looked at that in the circumstances? Was it reasonable not to? And you know, the context of the business is key. The context of the business, the expectations on an employer will be defined by the size of the business and the resources at their disposal. So what's expected of a small cafe owner who has no HR department and is running all the operations on their own versus what would be expected of, you know, the Ritz Hotel with its massive resources would be very different.
Interesting. The one case that we keep hearing, so first and foremost, I think it's worth clarifying that in order for someone to be classified as disabled with mental health, they have to experience a mental health issue for 12 months or more. Are you able to give us any better granulation of detail on that, on whether or not that's a self-diagnosed illness, or if that's a GP or medical professional's diagnosis written down, documented somewhere? How does that work usually? Yeah.
This 12 months or more thing is interesting because it's been clarified in case law. Don't ask me for the names of cases. But the 12 months or more is either a condition that has lasted that long, so somebody's been suffering already with it, or it's likely to last that long. So somebody that's experienced a mental health crisis, for example, that's new, but it's very serious, won't be able to satisfy the it has lasted 12 months, but they might be able to satisfy that it's going to last 12 months. And there I think you are going to need a medical opinion. You're going to need a GP or a mental health practitioner to come in and say, right, this is the severity of the episode, this is the treatment pathway, and, you know, we will need to review again at these points. And from that evidence, that opinion, you would be able to, ultimately a tribunal would have to decide whether that is a condition that's likely to last 12 months or more. I don't think it would be difficult in that scenario. If somebody's experienced a severe mental health episode and is being treated clinically and is on a treatment pathway that's going to last some months, and I think be very easy for that to be a disability. Yeah, the granularity around the, so yeah, do we have to get doctors involved? Not necessarily. It depends on the condition, the impact. What I would say is a diagnosis is always helpful. Mm-hmm. But it's not the whole picture. So if a case is brought on a footing of disability and the employer says, no, we don't agree, we don't accept that you have a disability. Yeah, we know you've got a mental health illness or condition, but we don't accept that when you were employed with us, it was a disability. And that's the important moment in time that has where it has to be assessed, not some months later, but what was going on at the time when this thing happened in the workplace. So if the employer says, no, we don't accept it, well, what would be expected of the employee? They'd have to produce their own evidence of the condition that they're suffering from, how long it's been going on, and how it affects their day-to-day life, including you know, work, inside of work, outside of work, social life, ability to live independently, all of the aspects of life. And the test is it putting them at a substantial impact? And the wording of substantial has been, you know, again, through case law, interpreted as more than minor or trivial. So it's a very, very low bar, very low bar indeed. It won't always need a doctor or a GP. But as I say, if somebody hasn't been under the care of their GP or some other clinician and says, well, I've got a mental health problem, I'm self-diagnosed, it may not help them that they haven't had assistance, clinical assistance with it, or sought treatment in the past. It would, you know, it would be a case of understanding how long these symptoms have been going on for and why now, why are they saying now, why didn't they disclose it before to their employer? They're not under an active duty to disclose, but if it's become a problem, why have they not sought to, you know, discuss it, get some help for it previously?
If you're enjoying this week's episode, consider heading over to our website and supporting our ongoing work in destigmatizing mental illness and creating a healthier, happier, and more sustainable industry by purchasing some of our branded merchandise. We have a whole range of t-shirts, hoodies, chef's jackets, well-being journals, plus a whole host more available on Worldwide Dispatch. All funds raised from sales of these items go towards free to access e-learning content, as well as providing free support systems and help for those who may be experiencing difficulty with their mental health.
Well, yeah, further reinforces the argument to start more open dialogues about this and challenging stigma. But, you know, we've established, I think, in recent years that the stigma is it's a big beast and it's been well ingrained in our society and multiculturally for eons. So it's going to take time. But, yeah, again, it just goes to show that actually if you have concerns about your mental health and to speak to your employer and to ask for help from professionals to be able to get the support that you need, it leads into that same question, I guess. I'm just trying to think of the best way to phrase it, which is we hear from managers and employers, and we also hear from individuals. And the managers or employers are saying, and how do I manage someone who I suspect may not be unwell and that they may be using mental illness as a defense for their role or for their behavior? And I guess similarly, on the flip side, we also hear from individuals who go, I've just spoken to my employer about my mental health and the poor state of it, and they've now deemed me unfit for work and fired me. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm getting to, are there any top tips for both employer first and then employee when it comes down to both managing this and also to raising this with their employer and understanding their rights? So we'll start with the employer point of view first. That age-old question, which I used to get really, really pissed off about, which was, why do you always suspect that someone's lying when it comes down to illness? And they're like, well, we can't touch it, can't feel it, so how do we know? But actually, over time, I've become less angry about that and more, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to educate people. I was going, well, what would you do in that situation if it was migraines, for example, or if it was a broken leg? But have you got any specific top tips for employers that will allow them to have some consistency in line with employment law, duty of care, reasonable adjustments that will allow them to be able to hopefully encourage individuals to come back to work on a more permanent basis?
I think it comes down to trust. And I think in any context, in any sector, whether it's, you know, restaurants, hospitality or any other, it's about trust and openness. I see cases when they get to the sharp end. I don't see them when they're early on and there are informal coaching conversations or check-ins. I see them when the employer has got to a point where either they've had enough, this has got to end, this is taking up far too much management time, how do we do it, but do it in a compliant way? Or they've really tried hard. The sincere employers who really do want to get it right have tried hard, but they're getting to their wits' end, that they can't break through what becomes an impasse, really. Now, not every employee is going to engage with efforts to help them and understand and openness, encouragement to be open. But I think you can spot those pretty early on. And if it's not going to work, it's never going to work. and they probably need to move on. So I do a series of webinars, which I've started doing lately, called Recruit, Retain, Release. And the nub of the theme throughout them is about actually working out early on in a relationship, or even if it's an established, you know, employee's been there for a long time, but things start to go awry, something isn't right, they're not who they used to be, or they've just become unhappy or whatever. Working out very early on in that thing that's happening, whether there's something to rescue here, whether the person wants to be, sorry, I'm using the word rescue, but, you know, helped, supported, yes. And what can come of that if they are helped and supported. So I think it's always to the employer's benefit if they do something rather than nothing. I think turning away and ignoring a problem and hoping it will go well, the employee will just snap out of it, is never the solution. Because I think given all the laws around disability discrimination, and particularly the laws on unfair dismissal, you can't hope somebody's going to get the message and leave. We don't live in a society where employees will just go, oh, all right, then it's me. Expectations culturally are around employer doing better and doing the right thing and helping them and managing the situation. So it's never a good idea to do nothing. The doing something is tricky, but it comes back to my first word, which is about trust. So if managers have already got open relationships with their staff, their teams, their venues, whatever, however many people they're managing, if they've already got that level of openness that's been developed, and that's an investment, isn't it? That's an investment in time and energy and emotion. But if that's there as the foundation, I don't think these conversations have to be problematic. And I think you'll get the buy-in that you want to have, because people know that they will be listened to and that their concerns will be taken on board and that you will try and help. And that open communication piece, I think, is something that is missing from UK business generally. Very big sweeping statement, because we know, you know, there's a lot of stuff being done on people culture now. But one thing I've picked up sort of reading around managing poor performance and getting the best out of people and supporting with well-being and all the things that we hear a lot of noise around at the moment is we seem to have moved away in the UK from the way HR management used to be trained, if you like, in the 70s and 80s, was around process and communications and developing people managers. And we have moved away from that. And HR has become very transactional. It's about the recruitment piece. It's about the ER piece. It's about, you know, policy change. And almost the people element of it and the good management of people, which at the end of the day is around effective communication. It's about empathetic leadership. It's about, you know, compassionate. Right. So emotional intelligence, all these has been lost somewhere. We're not training the managers to do it. So they either become frustrated with people or feel helpless that they can't do what they need to be able to do for them. So that's my, it's quite a generic view, but that is my view on employers. It is much bigger than the in the moment conversation. And I'm not sure there's a lot you can do in the moment conversation to rescue things. If the reason for the mental ill health is work-related, there's going to be a lot to unpack there that isn't going to be solved in a, well, how can we help you now conversation. But if it's something that's happening outside of work and the employee feels supported anyway and engaged and knows that their employer is there for them, then they will unpack it and they will make themselves vulnerable, because it's about vulnerability, isn't it? Bringing that self, that part of yourself into the workplace and sharing it makes you very vulnerable. And you're either going to trust that your employer will listen and want to help as much as they can, or you'll think, no, there's no point.
Yeah, you're right. But that big word, trust, empathy, vulnerability, emotional intelligence, understanding that what you see and your perspective of what you see is just a layer, and underneath there could be that poor performance and that bad behavior, for example, within an organizational context, could be because of stuff going on at home or financial stress or health issues. And sometimes it just requires to have an authentic conversation with that individual and say, look, you're not yourself currently, and I don't have the answers for you. I can't necessarily fix it, but I'd like you to share them with me, and I would like to see if we can come up with a solution together. I mean, that just in itself is such an authentic, and I'm not going to say easy, because I think if you haven't had experience with those types of conversations, it's incredibly daunting, and you'd be bricking yourself if you think it's like opening up a door to a big black room and walking inside, because you don't know what's on the other side waiting for you. But I think if you can demonstrate and start to get used to the fact that you don't actually have to know the answers, and you're in a stronger position, right?
Yeah. And I think part of that conversation is about managing expectations. So we can try and work this out together, but I'm not going to be able to fix everything. And there'll be stuff that we can do as your employer, and there'll be stuff that we might expect you to do to work with us on this. And sometimes that management of expectations piece isn't in there early enough. And, you know, people get unhappy when expectations are not aligned, and they get unhappy very quickly. So a lot of the work I've done, I think, around the sharp end, when things have really, you know, the pathways have diverged ever such a lot. When you look at, you look through the paper trail and you see where things started, you can see points at which it perhaps could have been said differently. The expectation could have been set differently, and they could have, rescued the situation. Maybe not forever, but maybe a little bit more.
Sometimes people speaking Swahili and double Dutch, and although you're speaking the same language, sometimes there's just subtle nuances. And life's busy, right? And I think this is the scary thing for employers, especially around subjects to do with D&I, menopause, mental health, is that these are perspectives and thoughts and feelings and lives of individuals that often enough, when you're laser focused on getting into work, doing your tasks, looking after 100 people, making the company money, that sometimes you miss those subtle nuances, you miss those opportunities to forge a better culture and a stronger relationship, or maybe address something early before it gets to, as you say, the sharp end where you end up in litigation.
Yeah, I think some of these things do come down to the bigger picture of the leadership of the organization. If we talk about tick boxing versus really deep work on D&I, if you only prepared to use D&I as a recruitment tool to get people in through the door, and you're not thinking about it in terms of your people development and their engagement and their onward journeys, that's not an effective D&I strategy. It's not fit for purpose. And it's actually, disingenuous, because it's not really what it's all about. But yeah, but that recruit, retain, release model that I'm working on with webinars really is about having this idea that your people are your best assets, even though they can be bloody annoying and they'll take up 70% of your time and you'll feel exasperated, that actually, even though we live in an AI-driven world, particularly in hospitality, most businesses need people to drive them forward. They can't exist on software alone. So investing in your people, and particularly the higher skills, the higher thinking that is going to be needed when we see the full kind of, how AI is impacting the traditional roles that people are carrying out or have carried out, they're coming to work, doing this. When we see that's not the way it's going to be, there is going to be much more importance on higher human skills, because that's where the AI cannot compete with us. So if we're not investing in those higher human skills now, we're going to find it very difficult to find them in 5-10 years time. So for me, the training the good managers is fundamentally important. The training of emotional leadership is really important. You can train people to do these things. Some people are more naturally given to communicating with people, and that's personality driven and experience driven, but they can be taught as well, and they can be practiced skills. And if we invested in more time into really, developing good management training and education, I think we'd find we would crack some of these nuts. I was watching a really interesting program last night, nothing to do with employment law, by the way, but it was about the UK justice system. So it did interest me. It was talking about the criminal justice system and civil justice as well. But the presenter went into a young offenders institution in Norway and compared it to our system for dealing with younger offenders in the UK. And there were some interesting differences, because the prison system in the UK is in a bit of a mess, like everything else. prisons are overcrowded and they're more like breeding grounds for criminals than rehabilitation centres. The place in Norway was doing it completely differently and coming at it from a completely different angle. So there are no life sentences in Norway, rightly or wrongly, but most prison sentences are quite short, 2 to 3 years. And in the Young Offenders Institution, the focus isn't on punishment, it's on the rehabilitation and what's going to happen when you get out of the door. And I found it really interesting the way they come at that, because their prison officers are trained very differently to ours. They're trained to understand people behaviour, addiction, sociology. They're not trained just to be security guards and crowd controllers. So I think there's something in that about our attitude to employment as well, and how we treat people generally in our culture in the UK. About, you know, I don't think we've moved on, despite the pandemic, despite the rapid change in ways of working in the last 10 years. I don't think our mindset in the UK has moved on between the master and servant model, which is how employment law has evolved. Master and servant. Employees are here to serve. Employers are the master to get the best out of them. And that, you know, there's a lot of cultural stuff wrapped up in that. But I think having these conversations about honest and open communication and engagement and aligning expectations and working together does butt up against this master and servant model.
Yeah, it does. God, there's
sorry,
so much
to be... that's a bit loaded.
No, it's a really great point. There's so much to be said for, you know, if I say you do mentality and just the general lack of engagement I think you get from employees when it comes down to that sort of relationship. Like, I'd be completely fucked without my team, quite honestly. Yeah. The Burnt Chef project would not be anywhere near as good as it is now. And with that, I like to think that you're always going to have your differences with different individuals. That's the nature of the world. But I'd like to think that my team and I have a good general understanding. We have open dialogue. If we're not having great days, we're prepared to talk about it. If one of us has made the mistake, say I've said something wrong or put my foot out of line in terms of my context, then I'll be the first one to hold my hands up and go, okay, yeah, I've got that wrong. Because I want my team to feel like they are part of this, that it's, this is their part ownership as well, that this thing is, this beast is theirs, and actually the work that they're doing has meaning and has value. But when you start to look at that sort of like, look, you're employed to do the job, so just shut up and get on with it and just do it, you're not going to get that same level of culture or engagement. You're just going to have people who do it until something better comes along, because it's, as you say, it's that transactional value. It's that you pay me money, I'll give you a little bit of my time, but I'm not going to put 100% in, as opposed to I choose to give you my time because I value the experience and you show me that you value the experience, and so I'll stay with you for longevity. It's that retention piece, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that's becoming more obvious as an expectation, as a need with Gen Z and now Gen A, apparently. Gen A is our next.
Something, isn't it?
Gen A. So it is much more important to them than it ever was. Or they're more aware of it than, you know, my generation and my parents' generation. In, you know, the last 100 years has been a massive evolution, I think, of society and how we relate to one another, what we expect out of life and out of our economic activity, a massive shift. So I don't think employment law's kept up with that. Certainly not, it's not nowhere near. And I'm not sure organisational thinking has kept up with it. I'm glad I don't have to do the thinking, because it's not an easy one to crack, but it's got to. I think that, you know, we have productivity challenges in the UK, and I think that if we're going to meet those productivity challenges, something has got to unlock in people's engagement with why they work, how they work. And I think the ownership of work by individuals is a really important aspect of this. So owning mental health, owning resilience, owning financial well-being, rather than being passive actors in a thing that they have no control over, fundamentally important to outcomes, isn't it? I mean, they talk about this in health terms all the time. If, you know, patient-centered health, if patients feel they have ownership of the process, you know, the outcome could be massively different. Well, why don't we talk about employment and the world of work in that sense?
Oh, man. I'm in danger of this podcast going on for 2 hours. Like, you're, I just like, there's so
much.
There
might be a second installment.
Yeah, I think there has to be. I mean, like, maybe we do something in person or we do a webinar so that our global audience can join in as well. But I think, I don't know, for me, COVID was this lightning bolt to the brain that this time off that you suddenly realize that every single moment that you spend working for an employer, there is a transactional element of you choose to give your time to that. But also it started to get me to look at my finances, started to get me to look at my health. And rather than be just a willing participant in the seat of life and just truck on and, you know, hopefully someone will give me a pay rise one day and hopefully my health will miraculously improve if I don't do anything.
Yeah.
Actually, you start to outpace that. Do you know what I mean? In such a metaphorical way, but rather than going along at the same speed, you start to outpace it and go, actually, I need to understand more about budgeting. I need to understand more about investments. I need to understand what it is that's going to improve my cardiovascular system or to improve my mental health and well-being.
But you see, for some organisations, and it can't be at every level because, you know, as we said, small businesses have only got finite resources, but in some of the larger corporates, this is starting to funnel into the employer offering, you know, and bringing kind of holistic well-being into benefits packages. It's got to be something that will help. And I suppose, you know, for the employers, it's good because it distinguishes them from the competitive offerings that they might lose their talent to. And I suppose at the you know, the top, the cream of the corporate world, you've got to have your eye very, very, very much on that. But I think as a general point, even if employers can't offer those glitzy benefits, you know, like insured health and financial advice coming into the workplace, they could at least start working out what it is within their limited, you know, budget, their capacity that they could start to do. Maybe, you know, once a quarter, bringing in, you know, we've all got networks, haven't we? But financial advisors are very willing to come and sit in front of a possible audience who might benefit from their services. Why not think out of the box and bring somebody in for a lunch and learn? And same with health, you know, there are loads of people out there talking about menopause and mental health now, and giving your employees the time and space and the access to webinars, the kind of stuff that you do, and just giving them that safety, I guess, to do that without judgment and know that it's on offer during the working day, make a massive impact on engagement. And you know, the kind of, I keep coming back in my mind, and it's just something I need to read up more on. But in Birmingham, we have a part of the city called Bourneville, which is where the Cadbury's factory is, Cadbury's chocolate. And the whole model of Bourneville is, it's a village built for the workers that worked in the Cadbury factory back in the, I don't know, 1850s or whenever it was, late 1800s. And that, it wasn't just about building houses, it was about building community for the workers. Why? What was the point? So the workforce was well to work, was a ready-made workforce, not, you know, ill. And there was no NHS back then. So if they were ill, then, you know, they're either dead or close to it. So providing that kind of the wraparound arms of the employer to look after the workforce was good for business. And I think that's something we need to start getting into now. That there is a business case, there's a business reason, there's a business imperative for investing in your employees' well-being.
Well said. I just want to just circle back quickly because it's an important thing that we, I mean, we get multiple messages on a weekly basis from all around the globe for individuals who have found the confidence to speak to their employer about their health and well-being, and then the employer has not done the things that we have spoken about in terms of, you know, your adjustments and showing that you've got a role to play in effectively a duty of care and also a legal responsibility if they're over 2 years, which I still think is far too long.
It's probably going to come down. If Labour end up leading the government, then I think they'll bring it down to a year.
Yeah, just, you know, to understand that you've given your heart and soul to an organisation for 2 years and you could be let go on that 1 year, 364 days, and that's it. And I know full well that that's a tactic that not organisations necessarily in hospitality use, but it's a tactic. So what about those individuals who then perhaps have been dismissed or are being unfairly treated with regards to their overall health and well-being? Could be menopause, could be financial, could be, you know, mental health. What can employees do?
Yeah. what's in their toolkit. I find this one really difficult because I think it's very limited, unfortunately. So if it really is a case of, you know, employers not willing to listen, they won't help, they won't support, they won't take it into account, you know, as a factor in poor performance, they won't do the necessary digging to, you know, maybe get advice on occupational health, get the health assessed, then there's one blunt instrument that an individual can use, and that's a grievance, internal grievance procedure. But in my experience, most grievance procedures are just procedures. They're not meaningful exercises. They usually end up being rejected, not given serious, you know, thought or consideration, not investigated properly. Or if they are investigated properly, the employer piles all its energies into making sure they have ticked all the boxes, dotted the I's, crossed the T's, and they reject the grievance, but they give it a lot, you know, make it a very detailed decision. So almost all the resources are going into the defence, the risk management, rather than addressing the what's really the complaint, you know, the concern. So grievance is one thing. It's unlikely to get the result that the individual is wanting. It's unlikely to unlock the problem. And then, unfortunately, unless this is a scenario where somebody is facing dismissal through poor performance or absence or disciplinary, then they're going to have to leave their employment to trigger a claim. And that's a massive risk. It's a massive risk for two reasons. It's an economic risk. You know, who's going to willingly leave a job that's paying the mortgage and putting food on the table? But the second reason it's a massive risk is if you voluntarily leave a job, and even if you say you've been put in a no-win position by your employer because they would not help you and they've backed you against the wall and this was your only option, unfortunately, I mean, you can frame a legal claim in that way, but it'll be down to you as the employee who left to prove that the situation gave you the legal right to claim you're effectively dismissed. It's quite a high bar. It's like asking somebody to jump the high jump. So when somebody comes to me in that scenario and says, I want to resign, shall I? My advice, pretty much 9 times out of 10, unless it's so toxic that it's affecting their health and they need to get out, my usual commercial advice to them is stay put. Do not leave, because then you would take on this risk with the legal claim. Stay put. If things are so bad that it's making you ill, go see your GP, get signed off sick, and then negotiate with them. But negotiation means a financial negotiation. It's never about staying in the job and changing the way things are. It's always about getting out. So coming back to your question, I think there are very few things that an employee can do who's really coming up against it. And it's usually a massive warning sign that this employer is not going to change its ways. If they know there's a problem, they would have done something about it already and they would be changing the way they do things. And if they're not, then it's not somewhere you want to be long term. You've got to get out.
Oh, breaks my heart that there isn't more support there. Like, you know, we signpost to various organizations in, you know, the States, UK, US and Canada. Australia has some really good resources, actually. Like, you know, the state of Victoria, for example. I mean, they just had a successful claim go through for $380,000 because it was proven in court that an employer didn't take proactive steps to reduce the risk of psychological harm, and an individual became mentally ill whilst employed for this employer. And because proactive steps hadn't been taken, there was a fine of $380,000, which I think is just like, you know,
we don't have a system of penalty like that for employers. I don't know of any organization that's going to fine an employer for breaching duty of care like that. The only recourse is, you know, compensation damages in a legal claim. But in that kind of legal claim, I guess the employee would be saying, you've damaged my health through breaching the duty of care. They don't necessarily have to leave their employment, but they'd have to bring a civil claim in the court system and, you know, pay lawyers to run that for them. And that claim might not get decided for 12 months, 2 years, maybe even 3 years down the line. So it's a long, difficult and costly process. And that's the point I'm trying to get across, that if Of course, we'd like things to be better in the moment, in the workplace. We'd like the systems to be there. If they're not, the legal system isn't, it's not very agile. So in many ways, it's going to make matters worse for the person who feels they've been injured, because they're going to have to go through this system that really drags them down, costs them a lot of money. They might get the cost back at the end of the day, but it's not going to help them move on and solve the problem, is it? So I understand entirely why, you know, cases are brought and some of them, you know, a point has to be made. And often they're backed, you know, the Equality and Human Rights Commission will back cases where it feels it can make a difference, and they're high profile cases, but they're few and far between. Not everybody would get the backing of the HRC, for example.
Well, I don't know. Who knows? We got asked recently whether or not we're going to start to lobby. But I think we've got a few projects that we need to finish off first, and maybe we'll start to look at that. But
yeah,
I know we're still very young in our journey when it comes down to discussing these subject matters. And you're right, I think the law is still quite rigid, and it hasn't really been changed much since the late 80s, early 90s in some cases.
I was around when the Disability Discrimination Act first came into being, and that's become the Equalities Act, but in 1995. And although the wording was already there in the Disability Act, nobody ever thought it was going to be used for mental health. Nobody was thinking about mental health back in the 1990s. No. It wasn't a thing. Mental health champions, mental health first aiders, no. So the idea that it would be used for mental, you know, maybe brain injuries and learning disorders, but mental health and well-being, not a thing. So that's a very recent development, to use discrimination law for conflict resolution where mental health and well-being is damaged or is not supported well in the workplace. So yeah, the thinking is still very young. You're right.
Well, I hope that this conversation, I mean, it's such, firstly, you're dealing with law, so it's never going to be as simple to be able to cram into an hour-long conversation, but hopefully the information in this conversation, I've certainly found for me, it's clarified a few bits, but it both gives a fairly weighted bit of information to employers and employees, and you know, employers to have authentic, transparent conversations that are empathic, are focused on making sure that it's the right result for both employer and employee. Have those conversations nice and early to save it getting down too far down the wrong path. Yes. And employees, you know, ultimately do take a proactive step in looking after your health. And if an organization isn't conducive to that, then consider raising it or consider finding an employer. And I think the great thing is that back 2-3 years ago, and my friends and people we used to speak to were like, I'm leaving hospitality because it's the same everywhere. I've been for 7 employers and they all treat me exactly the same. So this industry is the bad industry. But I think we're moving swiftly towards, well, hold on a second, before you go, try this one place. And then tell us if that is the industry or you've just had a run of really shit employers. Because there are a lot of them out there. You don't need any qualifications to run a business. You don't really need any money in some cases as well. And so...
And there's no policeman going to come and hit you over the head if you do it wrong. That's the point, isn't it? There's no penalty. There's no fines for, you know, being a bad employer.
No, not at all. No, exactly. So... hopefully the information in here has been useful, but I think Liz would like to do some more with you in the future.
I'd love to do it. Yeah, there's a lot more to talk about, isn't there? Let's do it on a sunny day. Although, actually, spring has arrived in Birmingham.
Oh, it's pissing it down here. But then we've got some ambassadors in places like Calgary at the moment, and it's heavily snowing. Businesses are shut at the moment. So you're like, you know, I don't know.
What would you prefer? Yeah, the least worst scenario. I think I'd prefer the snow.
We usually ask our guests, if we have time, what sort of advice would you pass on to your younger self? And you've lyrically brought something in. I just wondered if you could share that with us.
Yeah, I've forgotten the words now. You might have to repeat it back to me. But is this the one from the song? Oh, I love it. Do you know the Baz Luhrmann song, Sunscreen? If not, check it out. It's a classic and it's full of great life advice. And the reason it's called Sunscreen is because it starts by saying to the class of, I don't know which class it was, class of 76, my biggest piece of advice to you is wear sunscreen. And then he goes on to dispense lots of other advice. And then he comes back at the end and says, but don't forget about the sunscreen. But in the middle of it, I mean, there's so many great things in it, like dance, stretch, visit New York, visit LA. But this line that I've picked out of it is about the race is long and sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind, but in the end, the race is with yourself, not anybody else. So don't compare yourself to other people. Run your own race in life.
That's such a profound takeaway. I think that, yeah, especially if there's anyone listening to this who is younger or does have children, I think that the social media, digital technology is training us now to spend more time looking outward than inward. Mm. And so I think that that's a really profound takeaway, which is, yeah, you're only fighting yourself in this world. Like, the sooner that you can,
yeah,
that you can win that race with yourself, the faster you'll start to outpace everyone else as well. Then it'll be you that they look at.
Yeah, isn't there another expression? The comparison is the thief of joy. In other words, if you're constantly looking sideways, you're not going to celebrate what's good in your life. You're going to miss it. So yeah, eyes on yourself.
Well, thanks. Profound. Liz, thank you ever so much for today. It's been an absolute pleasure. If people wanted to sort more advice from you or to find one of your webinars,
they can find me on LinkedIn, Liz Burley, and liz@burleylaw.co.uk is my email. Yeah, how else can they find me? That's it. Our website, burleylaw.co.uk.
Wonderful. And a Burnt Chef Project has used your services before, and we're very, very happy. So
thank you.
We
that's great to collaborate with you. Really great
endorsement there as well.
Love what you do. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Chris.
No worries.